There's a few members of the public are let in every day. They're about five, six. And then there's a second courtroom in the courthouse where the trial is on closed circuit television that has another dozen or so members of the public are going in. And I kind of think that's amazing. I kind of am like, everybody should go.
New Yorker staff writer Eric Latch has spent the last 3.5 weeks in a New York City courtroom watching the criminal trial of former President Donald Trump. This historic moment in American history is also one of the most bizarre. And so on Tuesday, Eric came straight from the courtroom to the studio to tell us what it's been like watching the case up close. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. So you just came back from the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse, where Donald Trump is having his hush money trial. What happened in court today?
Stormy Daniels happened in court today.
Stormy Daniels happened.
There was, you know, the prosecutors in this case are not announcing the witnesses in advance. And so it's added sort of a layer of drama to like each, you know, it's kind of like the door opens and who's going to walk through it. And so this morning, you know, the rumor sort of broke early in the morning that today was going to be the day that the government called Stormy Daniels in to testify.
How did that go?
It was pretty extraordinary for all kinds of reasons. You know, Stormy Daniels came into the courtroom at velocity, like sort of walked into this side door that the witnesses come through. And like some of the witnesses sort of like you can tell they're being like dragged in.
Yeah.
But like Daniels went right up to the stand and started talking and just was just rare. I mean, you could just tell she's been waiting for this moment for a long time. And, you know, several times a court reporter had to tell her to stop and slow down because they just couldn't type. These, like, professional stenographers couldn't type fast enough to keep up.
What was, like, the most significant stuff that she said?
So if she would testify and what she would testify about and kind of how it would sort of relate to the and play into the rest of the case, it's been these, like, open questions in the case all along. And the two things I think that she talked about that are sort of the most significant for just the outcome of this case. I mean, one is just bluntly, she talked about having sex with Donald Trump and, you know, put that in front of the jury. You know, Trump's lawyers were very upset about how she described their, like, encounter and sort of the details of it.
She remembered being in the bathroom and seeing a leather toiletry case. And then when she walked out of the bathroom, she said she remembered seeing Donald Trump there on the bed.
Having Stormy Daniels say that she took a rolled up magazine and spanked Donald Trump in the butt, it's graphic. It is very specific.
And then, you know, the other thing that she talked about was what was in her head when she was paid the hush money before the 2016 election.
When asked about the nondisclosure agreement she signed in 2016 over the alleged affair for $130,000, she said she didn't negotiate for more money because she was doing well financially and just wanted the deal done.
I had not quite heard it sort of articulated the way it was in the courtroom before. And I think, you know, it was kind of one of these, if you're in the jury box in this trial and you're thinking about kind of this story, it was probably, I think, one of the questions that I think was the biggest was kind of like, well, what was the recipient of this money thinking when they got it? You know,
yeah.
And kind of what was this money for? So those are like the two big, big sort of things. Stormy's descriptions of Donald Trump were kind of setting aside the stakes of the case and almost like the politics of the nation.
Yeah.
It was like Stormy Daniels was clearly somebody who sized up Donald Trump like very exactly, kind of knew exactly who she was dealing with here and just was describing him the night that they met when she goes up to his hotel suite in Lake Tahoe and he invites her up for dinner. They never end up having dinner and they talk for like 2 hours. She was like talking about how he was asking her about like the porn industry. And she was like, yeah, you know, most people ask about the porn industry, like ask about like the salacious stuff, like the sex or whatever. And Donald Trump was like, so do you guys have unions? Like what are the residual deals? Kind of like he wanted to know like the kind of like nitty gritty practical material issues that go into the adult entertainment industry. And the way Daniels described it was like not with like, right? She was like genuinely kind of like, yeah, it's kind of interesting. This guy was like actually asking me genuine questions about my industry.
And what is Trump doing while all of this is happening? Because just like reading the reports of Daniels talking about how they had sex in the missionary position and they didn't use a condom, and how has he been acting throughout the trial as people say, you know, things on the stand that he must just be infuriated by?
You know, he's got like a couple different like poses that he like adopts like throughout the day. You know, the kind of standard one, the one he does most often, is like leans back in his chair, kind of lets his suit jacket fall open and his tie kind of hang out. And then he like sort of closes his eyes.
Which is why everyone thinks he's been sleeping.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, you know, early on, Maggie Haberman from the New York Times spotted Trump sleeping. That was like the first or second day of jury selection. And since then, I mean, every day, I mean, it's sort of become obvious that like Trump is like, I mean, maybe he is sleeping, but he's also sort of obviously demonstrating how little he cares about the proceedings in front of him or how much he can kind of tune it out. He posted that he, you know, he's not sleeping, that he's like closing his beautiful blue eyes.
I simply close my beautiful blue eyes sometimes, listen intensely, and take it all in.
Yeah. And like he is like, so, you know, this was in the piece about Hope Hicks's testimony that we worked on. When Hope Hicks, his former White House aide, was testifying, he had his eyes closed and she made a joke about Michael Cohen. She was like, you know, he used to call himself a fixer, like Mr. Fix-It. But I used to say like, that's just because he broke it first. And like Trump's eyes were closed and he was leaning back, like he was in the like sleeping position. But like I saw him smile when Hope Hicks said that. So he was clearly kind of paying attention, even though he also just kind of visibly looks like he's like tuning it out. That's like one of the things he's doing in there. And then there's with a couple of the Trump Organization employees who've testified, he's been a little bit more alert and a little bit more kind of like the boss, I think, leaning forward at the defense table and like looking at them. When there's moments that are, one would assume that he's unhappy, he is kind of jawing to his lawyers and kind of like getting their attention, kind of whacking them on the arm and sort of leaning into their ears and kind of like going back and forth with them. So, you know, with Daniels, I mean, he's playing this very deliberate, I think, and high stakes kind of cat and mouse game with the judge about what he's allowed to do in the courtroom.
So you've covered Trump's other trials in New York, the civil trials, and you've written that when it became clear that the technical arguments that his lawyers were trying to make weren't working, that he would resort to acting out, you know, antagonizing the judge, muttering and complaining in earshot of the jury. And I'm wondering how his behavior in the criminal case kind of contrasts with that.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing that's happening in this case is that, you know, the judge, Juan Merchan, has found him in contempt.
Can you explain that a little bit?
So before the trial started, the judge issued a gag order prohibiting Trump from making public statements about the jurors, potential jurors, or the witnesses in the case. And he didn't ignore it entirely, but he also almost immediately tested the limits of that gag order. And so from very early on in the trial, the prosecutors have submitted a number of his online posts to the judge and said, these are in violation of your order. Like, what are you going to do about it, basically? And the judge has so far held him in contempt for 10 different posts and fined him $1,000 for each offensive utterance. And the judge has acknowledged himself that $10,000 means nothing to Trump. And
yeah,
that this is kind of like an unsuitable remedy for like basically just flouting the court. But, you know, the judge is kind of in this position of like, how do you escalate sanctions against somebody who's just going to keep escalating? Today, you know, he was just sitting there. It's one of the amazing things about this trial is just that, you know, this public figure who has defined himself on like refusing to be contained for so many years just has to sit there for hours and hours and hours and listen to all this, like, at times tedious, at times embarrassing, at times damning evidence against him.
And so instead, he is doing this funny little game where he goes out and talks to the press outside the courtroom after the proceedings each day, right?
Yeah, there's this setup. So the courtroom is on the 15th floor of the Manhattan Criminal Court building, which is this like old New Deal era. It's like Gotham City's courthouse. And there's two elevator banks and a long hallway, and the courtroom is at the very end of the hallway. And they've set up this kind of like press pen for photographers and cameramen and a couple of reporters. And Trump has the option. I mean, this was done, judges said this, this was done explicitly so that Trump would have the option of speaking to the press in the courthouse as this trial went on. This is sort of a nod to the fact that Trump is running for president and has kind of different freedom of speech concerns than like the average American might have like during his trial. And
would you say that's like one of the main exceptions that's sort of made for him and his like unusual circumstances, or would you say that for the most part he feels like a normal defendant, and that aside from these little press conferences,
there's all kinds of exceptions being made for him. I mean, he's being treated like that's one of the ironies here. You know, it's like Trump leaves the courthouse and immediately talks about how unfair this whole process is to him.
And the trial is a very unfair trial. It's a very, very unfair trial. The good news is they have nothing. Thank you.
But the gag order alone and the way that he's played with it just for fun, no one else would be allowed to do this. And like this setup where he's allowed to like have little mini press conferences whenever he wants in the courthouse, nobody else would be allowed to do this. Even today I was like noticing, it's like you're not supposed to have phones in the courtroom. Reporters, you know, we are yelled at if they take a phone out. And Eric Trump, you know, one of Trump's sons was in the courtroom today just like scrolling through his phone. You know, it's like
that's privilege for
that's
you.
Privilege, exactly, exactly.
I mean, the thing is that it's easy for him to go after the witnesses in this trial because it's not like their credibility is unimpeachable. I mean, if you think about like the heart of the prosecution's case, you know, it's a catch and kill scheme between Trump, his former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, and David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer.
Yeah. I mean, Pecker was Pecker testified, I think, almost the entire first week of the trial. I think what the government wanted from him was, I mean, one is that he's the witness who has known Trump the longest. Like I think he said they met in the early 80s. And it was a kind of journey back in time to like Trump world and like the formation of Trump and Trump's like basic relationship with the media. A lot of this case is like about Trump's relationship with the media. And how Trump is like really a media creature, like more than a political creature. Like that's the thing I keep thinking. I mean, witness after witness sort of comes in and gives another revelation like on this level where it's like, you know, here's David Pecker who he's a little younger than Trump. He's in the early 70s, I think. Very grandfatherly looking kind of as opposed to Trump, like mild mannered kind of mousy guy. Lives in Connecticut, who was the president and CEO of the American Media Inc., which was the parent company of the National Enquirer. He was basically like the king, quote unquote, king of tabloids. And, you know, he spent several days on the stand, like very coolly and coldly and dispassionately talking about his business, which was like buying and selling basically people, you know, people's stories, their reputations, like leveraging people against each other. Trump's lawyers, you know, who have been trying or were trying earlier in the trial to sort of emphasize that the hush money payments that Trump paid and the arrangement that Trump had with Pecker and Pecker's media empire were like normal. I mean, that's the argument they're trying to make. This is all standard stuff, the standard way media companies work and the standard way politicians work. And so Trump's lawyers asked Pecker who else he bought stories for or about.
To prove how standard it was.
To prove how standard it was. And in the courtroom from the reporters, it was like, you know, can you take Pecker at his word was a question. But he's on the stand under oath, you know, and he's like telling a story about like Tiger Woods wouldn't do an interview with his media properties. And so they sent somebody out to take pictures. This was before Tiger Woods is all his scandals of Tiger Woods and some woman out at dinner who was not his wife. And then they got in touch with Tiger Woods' people and they said either he does an interview, either cooperates or we publish the photos. You know, he had this crazy story about Arnold Schwarzenegger about buying these like muscle magazines from a guy named Joe Weider who'd founded Flex and some other magazines. And one of Weider's sort of claims to fame was he was the guy who discovered Arnold Schwarzenegger working out in like Venice Beach. And Weider, according to Pecker, like Weider told them, you know, like sort of as they were putting this huge deal together, I mean, the sums of money were enormous. Pecker was like, I paid this guy $350 million in like 2003 for his magazines. And this guy Weider said to him, you know, you got to, but okay, but you got to meet with Arnold. Basically, you got to cut Arnold into this deal. And Pecker met with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was about to announce his run for governor. And Schwarzenegger sort of worked out an arrangement with Pecker where he was going to be an editor at large. And he was basically like, I don't want you to run any bad stories about me. And after Arnold announced his run for governor, women came forward with stories about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Pecker snapped them up for between $500 and a couple thousand dollars.
What is a jury doing when they hear, like, oh, yeah, we bought all these stories about Arnold Schwarzenegger or, you know, I mean, the jury Tiger
like,
Woods, you know?
Jury is like, you know, the jury is a fascinating, a whole other fascinating element of this room. The courtroom is like, you know, you've got the judge on the bench and the prosecutors, is like five or six prosecutors and paralegals. And then you've got like Trump has like three, four lawyers at the defense table with him plus a couple other lawyers. Like he's got a couple of aides in there. Then there's like court officers and court clerks. But then there's like 50 reporters in the gallery. And, you know, reporters have, you know, there's a certain kind of personality type that pervades. And like when funny stuff gets said, like the reporters like to laugh, like to the point where it's almost like, all right, everybody just, I mean, the court officers are constantly, it's a real kind of, it's like a middle school detention vibe. The court officers are constantly telling the reporters to quiet down and put their phones away, et cetera.
I'm so annoyed by you guys already. The reporter is just
you can imagine.
Chuckling.
Exactly. Just kind of like archly chuckling, like we're in on the joke. The jury is not, for the most part, doing that. Astounding things are being said. What I'm starting to feel like is like they're taking this trial seriously and literally. They have been tasked with doing something pretty huge, which is potentially branding the past and maybe future president of the United States a felon. And there must not be a lot of room for laughter in that, you know, if that's your job. And they're not. They're not really reacting to a lot of this stuff. Like they've had some moments when Hope Hicks was on the stand and was being questioned by one of the prosecutors. Like they were kind of ping-ponging very visibly kind of back and forth like they were in that one in a, you know, in one of the closing scenes in Challengers or something. and they all have notebooks. I think almost all of them, the judge at the very beginning of the trial offered them if they wanted to take notes, like they would be given provided notebooks and pens by the court, and they all put their
hand. Say like NYGov or something?
They have to leave them on their seats. And then at the end of the trial, the judge made this very clear, at the end of the trial, they're destroyed. Like they can't take them. They can't take it with them or like make notes for their memoir.
What
or like
an amazing
whatever.
Metaphor. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So one of the witnesses who seems especially crucial to the prosecution's case is Michael Cohen, Trump's ex-lawyer and fixer. In court, prosecutors have played a recording of Cohen and Trump in which the two of them are discussing how to arrange a payment to the model Karen McDougal.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David, you know, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and spoken
to me.
So Cohen hasn't testified yet. But can you explain the significance of that tape for the prosecution's case? Like, what is going on there?
Yeah, a couple different things. I mean, one of the things that the prosecution seems like they feel they need to prove is that this wasn't just Trump's underlings doing something without him, you know, explicitly okaying it, directing it. And so that tape, in addition to just being like kind of astounding physical evidence, you know, of Trump's voice in a way that I had never heard Trump quite talk as casually as that.
Maybe because of this, it would be better if you didn't go, you know, maybe because of this, for that one, you know, I think what you should do is get rid of this because it's so false what they're saying. It's such bullshit.
It's very clearly the not for broadcast Trump voice. And so there's an intimacy to it and a casualness to it and a profanity involved in it that I think is very compelling in terms of the relationship that Cohen and Trump had.
That's so interesting because even before he was president, I mean, we only knew him through what we saw of him on television.
You know, and the other thing that has come up in this trial, you know, is the other time that we've all heard Trump speak this way is the Access Hollywood tape.
Yeah.
You know, which this case is also partially like a relitigation of the Access Hollywood tape. Here's what's amazing. Trump survives the Access Hollywood tape to everyone's astonishment. You know, this tape comes out of him bragging about grabbing women's genitals and he's still elected president. And there's all kinds of arguments about why that is. But you know, here in this criminal case, the judge is like, if a jury hears this, they'll just convict him. Like, they can't be allowed to hear it.
Yeah.
Because it's too damning. It's prejudicial. Even though the whole country heard it and like
and the whole concept of the case is about Trump being worried about hearing things.
Yes.
Hearing negative things about him and the sexual encounters he had.
Basically, like, you know, to answer your question, like the tape, you know, kind of hits at that level. I think the kind of like, does Trump sound guilty, you know, kind of question.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, the details of how they're talking about this payment and Trump's knowledge of this payment and what this payment is about. So what they're talking about there is not the payment to Stormy Daniels. It's the payment to Karen McDougal, which was made by David Pecker's company, AMI. And ultimately was never reimbursed by Trump for sort of complicated reasons that Pecker went into on the stand. And for that reason, it's not part of the criminal charges against Trump. But it's still a kind of knowledge of, I mean, because part of what the prosecutors have been trying to do in this case is sort of paint a picture of an overall conspiracy that involves multiple payments to multiple people to bury negative stories about Trump to help him win the 2016 election. And so that tape is sort of, that's why that's sort of the kind of powerful evidence that it is, I think.
So you've talked about the weirdness of hearing Trump speak casually in a private setting. And I'm wondering what other unexpected personal details have emerged during the trial about him, just like things witnesses have said either about the way that he conducts business or the way that he ran his campaign.
I mean, another interesting aspect here is like quite a number of people said very nice things about Donald Trump.
Hmm.
You know, like, I mean, David Pecker spoke with real admiration, you know, about Trump. It was like kind
he's
of like
a good guy.
I mean, even more than that, it was just like respect for the master. You know, it was like it was a kind of like, you know, like Pecker. Here's this guy, Pecker, who's like sort of a very astute practitioner of like the dark arts of reputation and media management, you know, and it was like Trump was like this amazing, you know, kind of he could sell, like, you know, he moved magazines, he moved issues off newsstands, you know.
And that's funny because you could imagine there being some kind of like macho admiration thing going on, like, you know, alpha respects alpha. But even some of Trump's like former employees.
Right. Hopick said he was a great multitasker and she was the communications director. Her role was communications. And she was just like, well, Trump was the boss on that because he was the best at it. His former executive assistant, Rona Graff, talked about Trump being a respectful boss, you know, and a good boss. Thought about her family and, you know, let her out of the office early when things were, you know, when there was a long day. And so there's been that aspect to a kind of, I think, a more little visibility of like, I mean, you know, the defense attorneys have asked a number of witnesses who worked at the Trump Organization about this, like sort of like, they're like, yeah, it's a family business, right? Like, and everybody's like, yeah, yeah, it's like a family business. It's sort of intimate, very direct. The former controller, this guy, Jeff McConney was his name, and his job was to basically bring Trump the balance sheet. for his review. And one day he comes into Trump's office in Trump Tower and he drops the balance sheet on the desk. Trump's on the phone and Trump picks up the piece of paper and he sort of glances at it and he puts his hand over the receiver on the phone and he says, Jeff, wait a second, you're fired. And and it sort of startles like this guy. He's like, no, you're not fired, but like these numbers are going in the wrong direction. And it's like he's basically like, These are like the records of payments being made.
Yeah.
And Trump was like, your job isn't to pay these people. Your job is to keep my money coming in and sort of minimize these payments as best you can to make sure the numbers keep going in the right direction. And McConney told this as a very kind of heartwarming sort of business lesson story. But it was also kind of, you know, just – I mean that McConney started working at the Trump Organization in the late 80s, I think. And, you know, so this was just also the Trump persona from 30 years ago being brought into like a Manhattan courtroom in 2024.
So Michael Cohen has yet to testify. And he's had a habit of going on TikTok lately.
All righty. Well, another great night. And let me say goodnight to each and every one of you. Thank you for joining. But I just want to get rid of some of these MAGA trolls. You know, read a book, listen to the news, and not the news like Fox News or...
During these live streams, viewers also pay him in TikTok coins, which he can convert to real money.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that this kind of behavior could impact the case at all?
Yeah. Reportedly, part of the reason that federal prosecutors never brought this case against Donald Trump after getting Michael Cohen to plead guilty to making the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen serving time, and federal prosecutors never brought this case against Trump, reportedly because Cohen is a tricky star witness that has real liabilities, not just like pled guilty to this crime, but like has told this story many times in different ways, you know, because he was with Trump, then he was against Trump. You know, he's kind of told this story multiple different ways over the years. He, since breaking with Trump, has declared, you know, vendetta, basically, has nothing but an axe to grind. And, you know, I think these posts online, I mean, I don't know Cohen, but what he's clearly doing is baiting Trump. I think what he's really doing is like these guys are just like, you know, practicing like the politics of like humiliation. And like Trump has one hand tied behind his back with the gag order and Michael Cohen is taking advantage of that and like laughing in his face and provoking him and trying to get him to strike back.
You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you have thoughts or questions about today's episode, send us an email or a voice memo to themail@newyorker.com. Be sure to put the political scene in the subject line.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Can you talk about what Trump's legal strategy seems to be shaping up to be? Like, I know that he's consistently denied having an affair with both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal.
Right.
But what are his lawyers trying to say happened?
Yeah. So there's a couple different ways that they've gone at this already. One is, like we talked about earlier, the kind of like, this is normal campaign behavior. Yes, there was checks cut and coordination with the media company and okay, but like, you know, all candidates coordinate with media companies and all candidates protect their reputations and all – so this is sort of – there's the kind of like business as usual argument. Then there's the underlings argument, which we also kind of touched upon earlier, that they've sort of hinted at in a couple different ways, which is like, okay, yes, you know, Michael Cohen did these things and some Trump Organization employees, notably Alan Weisselberg, the former CFO – you know, may have also been involved, but kind of getting to boss level. Have the prosecutors really gotten there? You know, it's like that kind of argument has also kind of been visible at a couple different moments in the trial. Trump denies ever having sex with Stormy Daniels or with Karen McDougal. But what his lawyers have allowed at various times is that if he made payments, they were to sort of protect his family and his relationship with his wife and protect Trump from, like, personal embarrassment. I mean, Susan Nicholas, one of Trump's lawyers, explicitly asked Stormy Daniels this afternoon, we're recording on Tuesday, did you extort Donald Trump? Were you forcing him to cough up money, you know, in distress? They hinted at that when Daniels' former lawyer, Keith Davidson, was on the stand. So they've argued that.
So why were they hanging out if not because right. It was sexual?
And so here's the, yeah, so this is the last sort of place that they've been going, which is that Trump can't deny that he knew Daniels. She went to Trump Tower once for a meeting with him. She was seen there. They attended a couple of events publicly together. Her cell phone number was in Trump Organization records. So, like, in contrast to E. Jean Carroll, who sued Trump for sexual assault and defamation, and Trump has always to this day maintains that he never met her, even though juries have found against him and have, as a matter of law, said that they did know each other and that he assaulted her. Trump can't say, I never met this woman. This woman's, like, totally making
up the weird relationship.
Yeah. Who's that? But what Trump's lawyers have suggested, and this is sort of – they're helped in this way by Stormy Daniels' testimony, is that what Trump was interested in was maybe casting Stormy Daniels on The Celebrity Apprentice. So you know, that's the other element of, like, Trump's history and Trump lore that's sort of come up in this case. You know, it's like the Access Hollywood stuff, 2016, David Pecker and the tabloids, Trump Tower, but then it's like The Apprentice and sort of what the importance of The Apprentice was for Trump. You know, several of the potential jurors, when they were being interviewed, like, said that they watched The Apprentice. You know, it's sort of been in the air that this guy was on TV with this hit show for many years. Stormy Daniels has said this, that Trump, when they met, is sort of one of the reasons that they kept in touch was that Trump had this idea, or said he had this idea, of casting her on The Celebrity Apprentice, which even she says was crazy. Like, she says, like, basically he brought it up the first night that they met. And she said, that's crazy. NBC will never let a porn star on air. Like, you know, it's like, that's just never going to happen. But that he kind of would bring it up and sort of suggest it. And in some ways, again, like, this was sort of goes back to, like, Stormy Daniels having this kind of, like, sort of respect for Trump's thinking as a kind of, like, media operator, where he was pitching her on, like, well, that's the narrative we'll pitch. You know, everybody will think you're, like, the blonde bimbo, but, like, you'll come on and you'll be, like, this smart, like, kind of, like, entrepreneur who, like, knows what she's doing, and, like, you'll wow everybody. That's something that Stormy Daniels has said that Trump's lawyers have really keyed in on, that Trump was interested in Stormy Daniels as a potential contestant on his hit reality show and nothing more.
It's amazing that so much of this trial could be about The Celebrity Apprentice, and it kind of feels like the entire thing is just this very strange blast from the past. I'm wondering what it's like to be in the courtroom revisiting these events from nearly a decade ago, kind of a cast of characters, people who I thought I'd memory hold, you know, like who Hope Hicks was, but now she's on the stand and she's crying. I mean, what is it like to hear all of these things over again and see all of these people in the flesh in the context of today's election?
You know, one of the arguments that Trump's lawyers made in the run-up to the trial was that these are just old charges, and so who cares, and why should they be brought now, and what's the fairness of bringing them now, because the events of 2015 and 2016 are so long ago. But I don't think, like, Americans – I don't think anybody in the jury box is like, wow, these events are so long ago. You know, like, 2016 is still kind of just with us in this way. And so it's kind of this –
we never left 2016.
Yeah. It's sort of this processing of 2016 going on in that courtroom in a way that's, like, also makes this case stand out from the other cases that Trump is facing, which are all about 2020. You know, this is the 2016 case. And, like, oh, yeah, 2016 was crazy. What's happening here is kind of fascinating and terrible, kind of, like, recapitulation of, like, the events of, like, the last not just 8 years of American politics, but, like, several decades of, like, the intertwining of, like, the media, political, industrial complex. I kind of wish that there was, like, 300 million seats in the courtroom so that everybody could just take a seat and watch it.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Latch is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can read his work at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Gianna Palmer, with production assistance from Jake Loomis and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.